This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. Listen to us on KPFK, KPFA, and other Pacifica stations, and watch us on Free Speech TV, Monday through Friday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern. The election has many of us frightened with good cause. With large parts of the U.S. political landscape possibly rewritten after November 8th, the broader struggle for human rights among oppressed communities continues unabated, however. Nowhere is that struggle more apparent than in Cannonball, North Dakota, where an indigenous-led fight to protect the water resources off the Missouri River continues. Today, we take a break from the election coverage to revisit North Dakota and follow up with journalist Rose Aguilar, who's been on the front lines as water protectors have been tear-gassed, shot with rubber bullets, arrested, and charged with felonies as they work to stop the Dakota Access Pipeline. Rose Aguilar is a host of Your Call, a daily public affairs show on KALW in San Francisco. Welcome back to the show, Rose.
Hi, Sonali. Thank you for continuing to cover this issue.
So this is your last day in Cannonball, North Dakota. It's part of your second trip there. You've been on top of this issue. And since we last talked, these photographs of water protectors being pepper sprayed in the face by a phalanx of armed police officers emerged, kind of upping the already severe response from law enforcement against the mostly indigenous activists there. Can you tell us what the context of that horrific attack was?
Well, yesterday even, there was an action at the river where a number of water protectors gathered to pray, and then they decided to cross the river to try to take an area where Standing Rock Sioux tribal members say are burial grounds, they're sacred burial grounds, and on the top of the hill, covered with police and military gear. Now, this is the first action that I have attended because I missed a few of them. I did interviews, but it's a really intense experience to see these men in military outfits with all of their gear, and some of them had some sort of non-lethal weapon, and they set off tear gas canisters. And I met older and younger women who were hit with this tear gas, and they were completely traumatized by this. So you've got people flocking to the camp because they're seeing these videos. At the same time, a number of people who have been hit with tear gas or have been arrested are traumatized. I mean, the numbers just continue to increase. A number of elders are also arriving at the camp. And I met a number of women yesterday from Arizona, New Mexico, Oklahoma. And they said, you know, it's one thing to see the video, it's another thing to be here. And so many of the women I interviewed said, I am at a loss for words. It is so shocking to see this kind of response. I just didn't think this would actually happen when I got here. Some of the women just arrived yesterday, I should say Sunday morning, and they were met with that militarized police response. They were just in shock to see it up close.
Now, I understand that you've been speaking with both elders and youth who are from various tribal communities, including the Standing Rock Sioux. What sort of generational connections are being made among Indigenous communities at Standing Rock? A lot of some folks who I've spoken to said, for the very first time in a very long time, tribes have put aside their differences to unite on this issue, and it's been a really important experience for them. But within those communities, are you seeing a generational exchange of information, ideas, stories between youth and elders?
Oh, yes. At night, people gather around the fire and tell stories. The elders talk about the struggles that they went through as children and why maybe they weren't as vocal. A lot of it has to do with intergenerational trauma and the boarding school experience. And the youth say, you know what? It's time to use our voices and say enough is enough. And so the elders are saying, this is now up to you. It's the seventh generation after you. It's for you and your children. You have got to stop this. You have got to stop this pipeline, but you also have to stop the extraction and the fracking that's happening back home. There's also a little tension because you have a lot of elders who say, you know, we need to go to this front lines and pray. And a lot of youth say, well, you know, we've got 20 miles left of this pipeline and they're working nonstop. So we want to do nonviolent direct action. Yes, we have prayed up until this point, but we need to take this a step further. So it's really interesting to see the interactions between the youth and the elder. They're learning, they're talking, and they're also disagreeing on tactics.
Now, what about the announcement also recently by President Obama during an interview that the Army Corps of Engineers was considering an alternative route for the pipeline? Now, the broader struggle around ending the pipeline, destroying that project altogether, wouldn't necessarily be served by it, but at least the narrower struggle of the Standing Rock Sioux to protect their water would very much be satisfied, would be a big victory if there was an alternate route found.
Well, it would be nice if President Obama would actually come here, because when he said that the pipeline could be rerouted, I don't understand physically how that could happen, because Transfer Energy Partners, or Energy Transfer Partners, has been working 24/7 on constructing this pipeline. So at this time, that there's the 20-mile section that goes under the Missouri River, and the Army Corps of Engineers has jurisdiction over that section of the pipeline. The Army Corps and the Department of Justice have asked the company to voluntarily pause construction. So I just don't know physically how this pipeline at this point can be rerouted. I think it would have to cost the company a lot of money, and I just don't think that they'd be willing to do that. And physically, I just don't see how it would be possible at this point.
Are you disappointed that President Obama hasn't made a comment on the militarized response to water protectors? I mean, that aspect of it is just being ignored by our elected officials, that, you know, if, what, five or six law enforcement agencies from different states can come together armed with military riot gear, attack protesters, arrest and charge them with felonies. All of these things really going uncommented upon by both the major media and our elected officials.
Oh, I think this is huge. I mean, is this the new norm in the United States now? This militarized police, it feels like a war zone. It was so surreal, Sonali, to be on the front line on Sunday, to see these men who looked like soldiers with all of their gear and their guns. I couldn't tell what kind of weapon they had because I was down on the ground and they were up on the mountain, on the hill. But yes.
I mean, these photos could be from Iraq if you didn't see, you know, the Americans there.
Yes, in fact, the MRAPs that they have been sent from Iraq and Afghanistan back to the United States. The Department of Homeland Security is handing out billions of dollars in weaponry to even small police departments across the country. The journalists really need to be asking these questions. Why is it that elders are being pulled out of a prayer circle? Even young people who are there to protect their water source, they are arrested. They are charged with a felony. They have to pay $1,500 to get out of jail. They are in jail for 3 days. They have not been read their rights. Under North Dakota law, if you're charged with a felony, you have to submit a DNA sample. Every single person I've interviewed said, I was so traumatized in the jail, I didn't even know what questions to ask. I just wanted to get out. And so they gave a DNA sample. Now, I did get that confirmed with the Morton County Sheriff's Office. What I'm still trying to find out at this point is what is being done with this DNA sample? Is it for a state database or is it for a federal database? And now that people have had time to really think about what's happened to them, they're very concerned that they gave over their DNA without their written or verbal consent. A few people that I have met have said, I told them I didn't want to give them a swab, and they said that was fine. But the overwhelming majority of the people who were arrested on that Thursday violent crackdown, over 100 people, they were charged with felonies, and they had to give DNA samples. And Sonali, it's also important to point out that there's a lot of trauma that's happening at this camp. I met a few trauma counselors over the weekend who said that they are still finding women in their tents alone, in their cars alone. Everything was taken from them, including their cell phone. In some cases, they came back to camp with nothing, and they didn't know where to go for support. I mean, this is a really traumatic experience.
So the police are confiscating the belongings of people, just grabbing them and taking them away?
Well, when they were arrested, their personal items like their cell phones and their ID, and I've talked to several people who said their personal belongings were taken. When they left the jail, they had nothing with them. When I spoke with the Morton County Sheriff's Office, they said as protocol, we give everything back. And I said, well, what about Carol Mazden? She's a 69-year-old woman. She's been camping here for 3 weeks. She took a bus from Philadelphia. It took her 3 days to get here. She was in jail for 3 days. She now has pneumonia. She does not have her Medicare card or her ID. I actually bumped into Carol on Sunday when I was leaving the camp, and she said she finally got her ID and Medicare card back on Friday, and that's because she heard her name being announced on the loudspeaker at the camp. If she wasn't around that area, maybe she wouldn't have that ID. I mean, so many people still do not have their personal belongings back. So not only are they traumatized, but they don't have their ID card. I mean, that's your life. You're camping. You need an ID card to just have, you know, to do go about your daily functions and your life. But so a lot of things are still missing. People still don't have their cell phones, for example.
So Rose, how much would it help to have those gatherings at Standing Rock get bigger and bigger and bigger? Because that isolation, political isolation and media blackout serves the pipeline company Energy Transfer, serves the state of North Dakota that seems hell-bent to be on the side of this private corporation. But the bigger the gathering, can it help protect the water protectors?
Yes, that's what every water protector is telling me. In fact, over the weekend, the camp doubled in size, and I met families and couples who said, we could have sent money, we couldn't get work off, but we wanted to express solidarity for even one day. But the frontline water protectors have been telling me, we need bodies here. Yes, it'll be a traumatic experience. It'll also be an amazing experience because you'll meet people from across the country, members from over 300 tribes, but it's also going to be a traumatic experience if you come on a frontline action. But in order to continue doing these actions, we need the bodies, because at this point, the pipeline is being protected and the camp is surrounded. You can leave camp, you can come and go as you please, but it's incredibly difficult at this time to have an action along the pipeline because it's being protected by police.
So the whole fight continues to play out in the lead up to this election. I know as a journalist for you, you are having to weigh decisions about what to cover, and you're leaving the camp in order to do your own election coverage. But shouldn't this issue be front and center during our election coverage?
Well, yes, because it's a part of such a bigger conversation about climate change. One elder I met yesterday, we couldn't even hear each other because the wind was blowing so strongly. And she said, why are they building a pipeline in Indian country? It's windy. Where are the windmills? I mean, it's such a no-brainer. Not many people are talking about the election here at camp, but they sure are talking about climate change and embracing a different way of life. So this should be a crucial part of this election, because not only are you talking, there's so many issues. Not only are you talking about Native Americans standing up for their rights and the treatment of Native Americans in this country, and the fact that a lot of Native Americans here say, yes, we want you to learn about what happened to us, what happened to our ancestors, but this is what's happening to us today. And we want you to learn about treaties. Our treaties were broken. Learn about this. Learn about on whose ground you stand right, on whose ground you stand right now. Learn about that. And let's take this and look at what's going on in Indian country across this country, how there's fracking, there's extraction, there's oil pipelines. This is a much bigger conversation that we need to have about where we're going in the future. You know, we cannot keep digging and digging. It's not always going, there's not always going to be oil there. And then what's going to happen? And that's what people are saying here. At what cost do you contaminate our drinking water for our children? So yeah, this needs to be a major part of the election, because it is about the Dakota Access Pipeline, but it's also about such a bigger issue. What path are we going to be on in the future? That's the question. And so many people I've interviewed here say, we want to stop this pipeline, but it's about so much more than this pipeline.
Now, people in the course of election coverage talk about the Black vote, the Latino vote, the Asian vote. We rarely actually hear about the Native American vote. Rose, are you covering this issue? How do, you know, President Obama made a much bigger effort than previous presidents to reach out to the Native American community. And to her credit, Clinton has also made much more of an overture than other candidates have. other major party candidates, I should say. So any sense of how Native communities might be voting, any trends among Native voters, setting aside the fact that, you know, voting, particularly for communities that have been so historically oppressed, is such a tiny action?
Yeah, it's so true, because you've got a lot of reservations that still don't have drinking water. In fact, a number of runners from Arizona, from the Navajo Nation, arrived over the weekend. And one young man said, 40% of my tribe does not have basic infrastructure. They don't have drinking water. If you go to tribes in Montana, some of them, 10 years ago, the Blackfeet Nation, they just got paved roads and mailboxes. So Native Americans were about 2% of the population, and that's why Native Americans are not included in studies about housing, poverty, what have you. We're usually left out. And so when you look at Indian country, there's a huge effort to suppress the vote, just like other communities of color. And this year is no different from the last. In fact, it might even be worse. But unfortunately, you know, voting turnout in Indian country is very, very low because of what has happened in the past. Now, a lot of Native Americans are running for office this time around. Huh. So that's going to be really interesting. In fact, there is one congressman, and his name escapes me, but he's running in this area. And he is opposed to the Dakota Access Pipeline. He's Native American. His opponent supports the Dakota Access Pipeline. So that'll be an important race to watch. But if you're interested in this issue, Indian Country Today has been doing really good coverage on all of the Native Americans that are running for office. And if they win, this will be historic. It'll be one of the first women, for example, women Native Americans, if you can believe that, in Congress in 2016. I think she's running out of the state of Washington. So that's something to follow, because that's a really interesting phenomenon that's happening in Indian country.
Hmm. Well, Rose, I want to thank you so much for joining us today as you head back to the Bay Area where you're based and doing your election coverage. Thank you so much for all the work you do. And is there last time we gave out your Facebook page, facebook.com/vegandolphin, where people can see your show and also see the photos that you're posting. Any other websites you'd like to give out? I know people also ask you probably where they can donate to the Dakota Access effort against the Dakota Access.
Yes, you can donate to Ocheti Shakowin. It's OCETISAKOWIN camp.org. That's the main camp here. And I'm putting together vignettes, video interviews, just to give you a flavor of the people who are here. I'm also writing for 48hills.org, and I'm going to have a piece coming out in The Nation magazine about the DNA sampling and what is happening with the DNA that's been taken from people who've been arrested.
And we'll post links to some of those things that you mentioned. Thank you so much, Rose. Good luck to you.
Thank you, Sonali.
Rose Aguilar is host of Your Call, which is a daily public affairs show on KALW in San Francisco. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can find our interviews online at risingupwithsonali.com and also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes.